Good evening, good morning, fine afternoon, or best yet, happy bedtime. Because this is Tactically Kinky, and I am bringing you a little something special today. So, ladies, gentlemen, shapeshifting horrors from Lovecraft's imagination, this is the ideal time to take a deep breath, snuggle up with a pillow, and get comfortable, because I, dear listener, am going to attempt to read you to sleep. This is my favorite book in all the world, though I have never read it. How is such a thing possible? I'll do my best to explain. As a child, I had simply no interest in books. I hated reading, I was very bad at it, and besides, how could you take the time to read when there were games that shrieked for playing? Basketball, baseball, marbles, I could never get enough. I wasn't even good at them. But give me a football and an empty playground, and I could invent last-second triumphs that would bring tears to your eyes. School was torture. Miss Roginski, who was my teacher for the 3rd through 5th grades, would have meeting after meeting with my mother. "I don't believe Billy is perhaps extending himself quite as much as he might," or, "When we test him, Billy does really exceptionally well considering his class standing," or, more often, "I don't know, Miss Goldman. What are we going to do about Billy?" What are we going to do about Billy? That was the phrase that haunted me those first 10 years. I pretended not to care, but secretly I was petrified. Everyone and everything was passing me by. I had no real friends, no single person who shared an equal interest in all games. I seemed busy, busy, busy. But I suppose if pressed, I might have admitted that for all my frenzy, I was very much alone. "What are we going to do about you, Billy?"
"I don't know, Miss R."
"How could you have failed this reading test? I've heard you use every word with my own ears."
"I'm sorry, Miss R. I must not have been thinking."
"You're always thinking, Billy. You just weren't thinking about the reading test."
I could only nod.
"What was it this time?"
"I don't know. I can't remember."
"Was it Stanley Hack again?"
Stan Hack was the Cubs' third baseman for these and many other years. I saw him play once from a bleacher seat, and even at that distance, he had the sweetest smile I have ever seen, and to this day I swear he smiled at me several times. I just worshipped him. He could also hit a ton. I named a football player, and she just sagged at her desk.
"You've got a wonderful imagination, Billy."
I don't know what I said. Probably, "Thank you," or something.
"I can't harness it, though," she went on. "Why is that?"
"I think it's probably I need glasses and I don't read because the words are so fuzzy. That would explain why I'm all the time squinting. Maybe if I went to an eye doctor who could give me glasses, I'd be the best reader in class, and you wouldn't have to keep me after school so much." She just pointed behind her.
"Get to work cleaning the blackboards, Billy."
"Yes, ma'am." I was the best at cleaning blackboards.
"Do they look fuzzy?"
Ms. R said after a while. "Oh no, I just made that up." I never squinted either, but she just seemed so whipped about it. She always did. This had been going on for 3 grades now.
"I'm just not getting through to you somehow."
"It's not your fault, Miss R." It wasn't. I just worshipped her, too. She was all dumpy and fat, but I used to wish she'd been my mother. I could never make that really come out right, unless she had been married to my father first, and then they'd gotten divorced, and my father had married my mother, which was okay, because Miss R had to work, so my father got custody of me. That all made sense. Only they never seemed to know each other, my dad and Miss R. Whenever they'd meet, each year during the Christmas pageant when all the parents came, I'd watch the two of them like crazy, hoping for some kind of secret glimmer or look that could only mean, "Well, how are you? How's your life been going since our divorce?" But no soap. She wasn't my mother. She was just my teacher. And I was her own personal and growing disaster area.
"You're going to be all right, Billy."
"I sure hope so, Miss R."
"You're a late bloomer, that's all. Winston Churchill was a late bloomer, and so are you."
I was about to ask her who he played for, but there was something in her tone that made me know enough not to.
"And Einstein."
Him I also didn't know, or what a late bloomer was either, but boy did I ever want to be. When I was 26, my first novel, The Temple of Gold, was published by Alfred A. Knopf, which is now part of Random House, which is now part of RCA, which is just part of what's wrong with publishing in America today, which is not part of this story. Anyway, before publication, the publicity people at NOMF were talking to me, trying to figure out what they could do to justify their salaries, and they asked me who did I want to send advanced copies to that might be an opinion maker. And I said I didn't know anybody like that, and they said, think! Everybody knows somebody. So I got all excited because the idea just came to me, and I said, okay, send a copy to Miss Roginski, which I figure was logical and terrific, because if anybody made my opinions, she did. She's all through the Temple of Gold, by the way, only I called her Miss Petluski. Even then, I was creative. Who? This publicity lady said. This old teacher of mine. You send her a copy, and I'll sign it and maybe write a letter. I was really excited until this publicity guy interrupted with, we were thinking of someone more on the national scene. Very softly, I said, Miss Roginski, you just send her a copy, please, okay? Yes, by all means, he said. You remember how I didn't ask who Churchill played for because of her tone? I must have hit that same tone, too, just then. Anyway, something must have happened because he right away wrote down her name and was asking if it was S-K-I or S-K-Y. With the I, I told him. Already hiking through the years trying to get the inscription fantastic for her. You know, clever and modest and brilliant, perfect like that. First name? That brought me back to reality fast. I didn't know her first name. Miss was all I ever called her. I didn't know her address either. I didn't even know if she was alive or not. I hadn't been back to Chicago in 10 years. I was an only child. Both folks gone. Who needed Chicago? Send it to Highland Park Grammar School, I said. And first, what I thought I'd write was, for Miss Roginski, a rose from your late bloomer. But then I thought that was too conceited, so I decided, for Miss R, a weed from your late bloomer, would be more humble. Too humble, I decided next. And that was it for bright ideas that day. I couldn't think of anything. Then I thought, what if she doesn't even remember me? Hundreds of students over the years, why should she? So finally, in desperation, I put, for Miss Roginski, from William Goldman, Billy, you called me, and you said I would be a late bloomer, and this book is for you, and I hope you like it. I was in your class for 3rd, 4th, and 5th grades. Thank you very much. William Goldman. The book came out and got bombed. I stayed in and did the same, adjusting. Not only did it not establish me as the freshest thing since Kit Marlowe, it also didn't get read by anybody. Not true. It got read by a number of people, all of whom I knew. I think it's safe to say, however, no strangers savored it. It was a grinding experience, and I reacted as indicated above. So when Miss R's note came late, it got sent to Comp and they took their time relaying it, I was really ready for a lift. Dear Mr. Goldmoon, thank you for the book. I have not had time yet to read it, but I am sure it is a fine endeavor. I of course remember you. I remember all of my students. Yours sincerely, Antonia Roginski. What a crusher! She didn't remember me at all. I sat there holding the note, rocked. People don't remember me, really. It's not any paranoid thing, I just have this habit of slipping through memories. It doesn't bother me all that much, except, I guess that's a lie, it does. For some reason, I test very high on forgettability. So when Miss R sent me that note, making her, just like everyone else, I was glad she'd never gotten married, I'd never liked her anyway. She'd always been a rotten teacher, and it served her right that her first name was Antonia. I didn't mean it, I said out loud right then. I was alone in my one-room job on Manhattan's glamorous west side and talking to myself. I'm sorry, I went on. You gotta believe that, Miss R. What had happened, of course, was that I'd finally seen the postscript. It was on the back of the thank you note, and what it said was, idiot, Not even the immortal S. Morgenstern could feel more paternal than I. S. Morgenstern, the Princess Bride, she remembered! Flashback. 1941, autumn. I'm a little cranky because my radio won't get the football game. Northwestern is playing Notre Dame, which starts at 1, and by 1:30, I can't get the game. Music, news, soap operas, everything but not the biggie. I call for my mother. She comes, I tell her my radio's busted, I can't find the Northwestern or Notre Dame game. She says, "You mean the football?" "Yes, yes, yes," I say. "It's Friday," she says. "I thought they played on Saturday." Am I an idiot? I lie back, listening to the soaps. And after a little while, I try finding it again, and my stupid radio will pick up every Chicago station except the one carrying the football game. I really holler now, and again my mother tears in. "I'm gonna heave this radio right out the window," I say. "It won't get it, it won't get it. I cannot make it get it." "Get what?" she says. "The football game," I say. "How dumb are you? The game!" "Saturday, and watch your tongue, young man," she says. "I already told you it's Friday." She goes again. Was there ever so ample a dunce? Humiliated, I flick around on my trusty Zenith, trying to find the football game. It was so frustrating. I was lying there sweating, and my stomach felt crazy, and I was pounding the top of the radio to make it work right. And that was how they discovered that I was delirious with pneumonia. Pneumonia today is not what it once was, especially when I had it. 10 days or so in the hospital, and then home for the long recuperation period. I guess it was 3 more weeks in bed, a month maybe. No energy, no games even. I just was this lump going through a strength-gathering time period. Which is how you have to think of me when I came upon the Princess Bride. It was my first night home. Drained, still one sick cookie, my father came in. I thought to say goodnight, but he sat on the end of the bed. "Chapter 1, The Bride," he said. It was only then I kind of looked up and saw he was holding a book. That alone was surprising. My father was next to illiterate in English. He came from Florin, the setting of the Princess Bride, and there he had been no fool. He said once he would have ended up a lawyer, and maybe so. The facts are, when he was 16, he got a shot at coming to America, gambled on the land of opportunity, and lost. There was never much here for him. He was not attractive to look upon, very short and from an early age bald, and he was ponderous at learning. Once he got a fact, it stayed, but the hours it took to pass into his cranium were not to be believed. His English always stayed ridiculously immigranty, and that didn't help him either. He met my mother on the boat over, got married later, and when he thought they could afford it, they had me. He worked forever as the number 2 chair in the least successful barbershop in Highland Park, Illinois. Toward the end, he used to just doze all day in his chair. He actually passed away that way. He was gone an hour before the number 1 guy realized it. Until then, he just thought my father was having a good doze. Maybe he was. Maybe that's all any of this is. When they told me, I was terribly upset, but I thought at the same time that it was an almost existence-proving way for him to go. Anyway, I said, "Huh? What? I didn't hear." I was so weak, so terribly tired.
Chapter 1, The Bride.
He held up the book then.
"I'm reading it to you for relax."
He practically shoved the book in my face.
"By S. Morgenstern, great Florinese writer. The Princess Bride. He came to America, S. Morgenstern, dead now in New York. The English is his own. He spoke 8 tongues.
Here, my father put down the book and held up all of his fingers.
8. Once, in Florence City, I was in his cafe.
He shook his head now. He was always doing that, my father, shaking his head when he had said it wrong.
Not his cafe. He was in it. Me too. The same time. I saw him. S. Morgenstern. He had head like this. That big.
And he shaped his hands like a great big balloon.
Great man in Florida City. Not so much in America.
Has it got any sports in it?
Fencing, fighting, torture, poison, true love, hate, revenge, giants, hunters, bad men, good men, beautifulest ladies, snakes, spiders, beasts of all natures and descriptions, pain, death, brave men, coward men, strongest men, chases, escapes, lies, truths, passions, miracles.
Sounds okay, I said, and I kind of closed my eyes. I'll do my best to stay awake, but I'm awfully sleepy, Daddy.
Who can know when his world is going to change? Who can tell before it happens that every prior experience, all the years, were a preparation for nothing? Picture this now, an all but illiterate old man struggling with an enemy tongue, an all but exhausted young boy fighting against sleep, and nothing between them but the words of another, alien, painfully translated from native sounds to foreigns. Who could suspect that in the morning a different child would awake? I remember for myself, only trying to beat back fatigue. Even a week later, I was not aware of what had begun that night. The doors that were slamming shut while others slid into the clear. Perhaps I should have at least known something, but maybe not. Who can sense revelation in the wind? What happened was just this. I got hooked on the story. For the first time in my life, I became actively interested in a book. Me, the sports fanatic. Me, the game freak. Me, the only 10-year-old in Illinois with a hate-on for his alphabet, wanted to know, what happened next? What became of beautiful Buttercup and poor Wesley and Inigo, the greatest swordsman in the history of the world? And how really strong was Fezzik? And were there limits to the cruelty of Vizini, the devil Cillian? Each night, my father read to me, chapter by chapter, always fighting to sound the words properly, to nail down the sense. And I lay there, eyes kind of closed, my body slowly beginning the long flow back to strength. It took, as I said, probably a month. And in that time, he read The Princess Bride twice to me. Even when I was able to read myself, this book remained his. I would never have dreamed of opening it. I wanted his voice, his words. Later, years later even, sometimes I might say, how about that duel on the cliffs with Inigo and the man in black? And my father would gruff and grumble and get the book and lick his thumb, turning pages, till the mighty battle began. I loved that. Even today, that's how I summon back my father when the need arises. Slumped and squinting and halting over words, giving me Morgan Stern's masterpiece as best he could. The Princess Bride belongs to my father. Everything else was mine. There wasn't an adventure story anywhere that was safe from me. Come on, I would say to Miss R when I was well again. Stevenson, you kept saying Stevenson. I finished Stevenson. Who now? And she would say, well, try Scott. See how you like him. So I tried old Sir Walter, and I liked him well enough to butt through a half dozen books in December. A lot of that was Christmas vacation, when I didn't have to interrupt my reading for anything but now and then for a little food. Who else? Who else? Cooper, maybe, she'd say. So off I went into the Deerslayer and all the leather stocking stuff. And then on my own one day, I stumbled onto Dumas and D'Artagnan, and that got me through most of February, those guys. You have become, before my very eyes, a novel-holic, Miss R. said. Do you realize you are now spending more time reading than you used to spend on games? Do you know that your arithmetic grades are actually getting worse? I never minded when she knocked me. We were alone in the schoolroom, and I was after her for somebody good to devour. She shook her head. You're certainly blooming, Billy. Before my very eyes, I just don't know into what. I just stood there and waited for her to tell me somebody to read. You are impossible standing there waiting. She thought for a second. All right, try Hugo, the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Hugo, Hunchback, I said. Thank you. And I turned, ready to begin my sprint to the library.
I heard her words sigh behind me as I moved.
This can't last. It just can't last.
But it did. And it has. I am as devoted to adventure now as then. And that's never going to stop. That first book of mine I mentioned, The Temple of Gold, do you know where the title comes from? From the movie Gunga Din, which I've seen 16 times and I still think is the greatest adventure movie ever, ever, ever made. True story about Gunga Din. When I got discharged from the army, I made a vow never to go back on an army post. No big deal. Just a simple, lifelong vow. Okay, now I'm home the day after I get out, and I've got a buddy at Fort Sheridan nearby, and I call to check in and he says, "Hey, guess what's playing on post tonight? Gunga Din!" "We'll go," I said. "It's tricky," he said. "You're a civilian." Upshot, I got back into uniform the first night I was out and snuck onto an army post to see that movie. Snuck back. A thief in the night, heart pounding, the sweats, everything. I'm addicted to action, adventure, call it whatever you will, in any way, shape, etc. I never missed an Alan Ladd picture, an Errol Flynn picture. I still don't miss John Wayne pictures. My whole life really began with my father reading me The Morgenstern when I was 10. Fact, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is, no question, the most popular thing I've ever been connected with. When I die, if the Times gives me an obituary, it's going to be because of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Okay, now what's the scene everybody talks about, the single moment that stays fresh for you, and me, and all the masses? Answer? The jump off the cliffs. Well, when I wrote that, I remember thinking that those cliffs they were jumping off, those were the cliffs of insanity that everybody tries to climb in The Princess Bride. In my mind, when I wrote Butch, I was thinking back further into my mind, remembering my father reading the rope climb up the cliffs of insanity, and the death that was lurking right behind. That book was the single best thing that ever happened to me. Sorry about that, Helen. Helen is my wife, the hotshot child psychiatrist. And long before I was even married, I knew I was going to share it with my son. I knew I was going to have a son, too. So when Jason was born, if he'd been a girl, he would have been named Pamby. Can you believe that? A woman child psychiatrist who would give her kids such names? Anyway, when Jason was born, I made a mental note to buy him a copy of The Princess Bride for his 10th birthday, after which I promptly forgot all about it. Flash forward, the Beverly Hills Hotel, last December, I'm going mad having meetings on Ira Levin's The Stepford Wives, which I am adapting for the silver screen. I call my wife in New York at dinner time, which I always do, it makes her feel wanted. And we're talking, and at the close, she says, "Oh, we're giving Jason a 10-speed bike. I bought it today. I thought that was fitting, don't you?"
"Why fitting?"
"Oh, come on, Willie. 10 years, 10 speeds.
"Is he 10 tomorrow? It went clean out of my head."
"Call us at supper time tomorrow, and you can wish him a happy."
"Ellen," I said then, "listen, do me something. Buzz the 999 bookshop and have them send over The Princess Bride."
"Let me get a pencil."
And she was gone for a while.
"Okay, shoot. The what bride?"
"Princess, by S. Morgan Stern. It's a kid's classic. Tell him I'll quiz him on it when I'm back next week, and that he doesn't have to like it or anything. But if he doesn't, tell him I'll kill myself. Give him that message exactly, please. I wouldn't want to apply any extra pressure or anything."
"Kiss me, you fool."
"Mwah."
"No starlets now."
This was always her sign-off, when I was alone and on the loose in sunny California. "They're extinct, dummy." That was mine. We hung up. Now the next afternoon, it so happened, from somewhere, there actually appeared a living, suntanned, breathing deeply starlet. I'm lulling by the pool, and she moves by in a bikini, and she is gorgeous. I'm free for the afternoon, I don't know a soul, so I start playing a game about how can I approach this girl so she won't laugh out loud. I never do anything, but oogling is great exercise and I am a major league girl watcher. I can't come up with any approach that connects with reality, so I start to swim my laps. I swim a quarter mile a day because I have a bad disc at the base of my spine. up and back, 18 laps. And when I'm done, I'm hanging on in the deep end, panting away, and over swims this starlet. She hangs on the ledge in the deep end too, maybe all of 6 inches away, hair all wet and glistening, and the body's under the water, but you know it's there. And she says, "This happened now."
"Pardon me, aren't you the William Goldman who wrote Boys and Girls Together? That's like my favorite book in all the world."
I clutch the ledge and nod. I don't remember what I said. Exactly. Lie. I remember exactly what I said, except it's too goon-like to put it down. Ye gods, I'm 40 years old. "Goldman, yes, Goldman, I'm Goldman." It came out all in one word, so there's no telling what language she thought I was responding in.
"I'm Sandy Sterling," she said. "Hi."
"Hi, Sandy Sterling," I got out, which was pretty suave. Suave for me, anyway. I'd say it again if the situation came up. Then, my name was paged. "The Xanax won't leave me alone," I say. And she breaks out laughing, and I hurry to the phone, thinking it was really all that clever. And by the time I get there, I decide yes, it was, and into the receiver I say, "Clever." Not hello, not Bill Goldman. "Clever," is all I say.
"Did you say clever, Willie? It's Helen."
"I'm in a story conference, Helen, and we're speaking tonight at supper time. Why are you calling at lunch for?"
Hostile.
Never argue with your wife about hostility when she's a certified Freudian. "It's just they're driving me nuts. Crazy with stupid notions in the story conference. What's up?"
"Nothing, probably. Except the Morgensterns out of print. I've checked with Doubleday, too. You sounded kind of like it might be important, so I'm just letting you know Jason will have to be satisfied with his very fitting 10-speed machine."
"Not important," I said. Sandy Sterling was smiling, from the deep end, straight at me. "Thanks, though, anyway." I was about to hang up, then I said, "Well, as long as you've gone this far, call Argsky on 59th Street. They specialize in out-of-print stuff."
"Argsky, 59th, got it. Talk to you at supper."
She hung up, without saying no starlets now. Every call ends with that, and now she doesn't? Could I have given it away by something in my tone? Helen's very spooky about that being a shrink and all. Guilt, like pudding, began bubbling on the back burner. I went back to my lounge chair, alone. Sandy Sterling swam a few laps. I picked up my New York Times. A certain amount of sexual tension in the vicinity.
"Done swimming?" she asks.
I put my paper down. She was by the edge of the pool now, nearest my chair. I nod, staring at her.
"Which Xanax, Dick or Daryl?"
"It was my wife," I explain, emphasis on the last word. Didn't faze her. She got up and lay down in the next chair over. Top heavy, but golden. If you like 'em that way, you had to like Sandy Sterling. I like 'em that way.
"You're out here on the Levin, aren't you? Stepford Wives?"
"I am doing the screenplay."
"I really love that book. That's like my favorite book in all the world. I'd really love to be in a picture like that, written by you. I'd do anything for a shot at it."
So there it was. She was putting it right out there on the line. Naturally, I set her straight fast. "Listen, I don't do things like that. If I did, I would, because you're gorgeous, that goes without saying, and I wish you joy, but life's too complicated without that kind of thing going on." That's what I thought I was going to say. But then I figured, hey, wait a minute. What law is there that says you have to be the token Puritan of the movie business? I've worked with people who keep card files on this number of thing. True. Ask Joyce Haber. "Have you acted in a lot of features?" I heard myself asking. Now, you know I was really passionate to know the answer to that one.
"Nothing that enlarged my boundaries, you know what I mean?"
"Mr. Goldman?" I looked up. It was the assistant lifeguard. "For you again." He handed me the phone.
"Willie?"
Just the sound of my wife's voice sent sheer blind misgivings through each and every bit of me. "Yes, Ellen?"
"You sound funny."
"What is it, Helen?"
"Nothing, but..."
It can't have been nothing or you wouldn't have called me.
What's the matter, Willie?
Nothing is the matter. I was trying to be logical. You did, after all, place the call. I was merely trying to ascertain why. I can be pretty distant when I put my mind to it.
You're hiding something.
Nothing drives me crazier than when Helen does that, because she, with this horrible psychiatrist background of hers, she only accuses me of hiding things from her when I'm hiding things from her. Helen, I'm in the middle of a story conference now. Just get on with it. So there it was again. I was lying to my wife about another woman. And the other woman knew it.
Sandy Sterling, in the next chair, smiled dead into my eye.
Argosy doesn't have the book. Nobody has the book. Goodbye, Willie.
She hung up.
Wife again?
I nodded, put the phone on the table by my lounge chair.
You sure talk to each other a lot.
I know, I told her. It's murder trying to get any writing done. I guess she smiled. There was no way I could stop my heart from pounding.
Chapter 1, The Bride, my father said.
I must have jerked around or something because she said,
huh?
My father, I began. I thought, I began. Nothing, I said finally.
Easy,
she said, and she gave me a really sweet smile. She dropped her hand over mine for just a second, very gentle and reassuring. I wondered, was it possible she was understanding too? Gorgeous and understanding? Was that legal? Helen wasn't ever understanding. She was always saying she was.
I understand why you're saying that, Willie.
But secretly, she was ferreting out my neuroses. No, I guess she was understanding. What she wasn't was sympathetic. And of course, she wasn't gorgeous, too. Skinny, yes. Brilliant, yes. I met my wife in graduate school, I told Sandy Sterling. She was getting her PhD. Sandy Sterling was having a little trouble with my train of thought. We were just kids. How old are you?
You want my real age, or my baseball age?
I really laughed then. Gorgeous and understanding and funny?
Fencing, fighting, torture, my father said. Love, hate, revenge. Giants, beasts of all nature and description. Truths, passions, miracles.
It was 12:35, and I said, one phone call, okay?
Okay.
New York City information, I said into the receiver. And when I was through, I said, could you give me the names of some 4th Avenue bookshops, please? There must be 20 of them. 4th Avenue is the used and out-of-print book center of the English-speaking chapter of the civilized world. While the operator looked, I turned to the creature on the next lounge and said, my kid's 10 today. I'd kind of like for him to have this book from me, a present. Won't take a sec.
Swing, Sandy Sterling said. I list one bookstore called the 4th Avenue Bookshop, the operator said, and she gave me the number.
Can't you give me any of the others? They're all down there in a clump.
If you will give me their names, I can help you,
the operator said, speaking bell talk. This one'll do, I said, and I got the hotel operator to ring through for me. Listen, I'm calling from Los Angeles, I said, and I need The Princess Bride by S. Morgenstern.
Nope, sorry,
the guy said, and before I could say, well, could you give me the names of some other stores down there? He hung up. Give me that number back, please, I said to the hotel operator, and when the guy was on the line again, I said, this is your Los Angeles correspondent. Don't hang up so fast this time. I ain't got it, mister. I understand that. What I'd like is, since I'm in California, could you give me the names and numbers of some of the other stores down there? They might have it, and there aren't exactly an abundance of New York Yellow Pages drifting around out here. They don't help me, I don't help them. He hung up again. I sat there with the receiver in my hand.
What's this special book? Sandy Sterling asked.
Nothing important, I said, and hung up. Then I said, yes, it is. and picked up the receiver again, eventually got my publishing house in New York, and after a few more eventualities, my editor's secretary read me off the names and numbers of every bookstore in the 4th Avenue area.
Hunters, my father was saying now. Bad men, good men, beautifulest ladies.
He was camped in my cranium, hunched over, bald and squinting, trying to read, trying to please, trying to keep his son alive and the wolves away. It was 1:10 before I had the list completed and rang off from the secretary. Then I started with the bookstores.
Listen, I'm calling from Los Angeles on the Morgenstern book, The Princess Bride, and...
Sorry.
Sorry.
Busy signal.
Not for years.
Another busy. 1:35. Sandy swimming, getting a little angry now. She must have thought I was putting her on. I wasn't, but it sure looked that way.
Sorry, had a copy in December.
No soap, sorry.
This is a recorded announcement. The number you have dialed is not in working order. Please hang up and...
Nope.
Sandy was really upset by now. Glaring, gathering debris.
Who reads Morgenstern today?
Sandy, going, going, gorgeous, gone. Bye, Sandy. Sorry, Sandy.
Sorry, we're closing soon.
1:55 now. 4:55 in New York. Panic in Los Angeles. Busy, no answer. No answer.
Florinese I got, I think, somewhere in the back.
I sat up in my lounge chair. His accent was thick.
I need the English translation. You don't get much call from Morgenstern nowadays. I don't know anymore what I got back there. You come in tomorrow, you look around. I'm in California. It would mean a great deal to me if you'd just look.
You gonna hold on while I do it? I'm not gonna pay for this call.
Take your time,
I said. He took 17 minutes. I just hung on listening. Every so often I'd hear a footstep or a crash of books or a grunt. Finally,
well, I got the Florinese like I thought.
So close.
But not the English,
I said. And suddenly he's yelling at me.
What are you, crazy? I break my back and he says I haven't got it. Yes, I got it. I got it right here. And believe me, it's going to cost a pretty penny. Great. Really, no kidding. Now listen, here's what you do. Get yourself a cab and tell him to take you to the book straight up the park and...
Mr. California, you listen now. It's coming up a blizzard, and I'm going no place in neither of these books without money. $6.50 on the barrel each. You want the English, you gotta take the Florinese. And I close at 6. These books don't leave my premises without $13 changing hands.
Don't move,
I said, hanging up. And who do you call when it's after hours and Christmas on the horizon? Only your lawyer.
Charlie, I said when I got him, please do me this. Go to 4th Avenue, Abramowitz, give him $13 for 2 books, taxi up to my house and tell the doorman to take them to my apartment. And yes, I know it's snowing. What do you say?
Well, this is such a bizarre request. I have to agree to it. I called the bookstore again.
My lawyer is hot on the trail.
No checks, he said.
You're all hard.
I hung up and started figuring. More or less, 120-minute long distance at 135 per minute, first 3 minutes, plus 13 for the books, plus probably 10 for Charlie's taxi, plus probably 60 for his time came to 250, maybe? All for my Jason to have the Morgenstern. I leaned back and closed my eyes. 250, not to mention 2 solid hours of torment and anguish, and let's not forget Sandy Sterling. It was a steal. They called me at 7:30. I was in my suite.
He loves the bike, Helen said. He's practically out of control.
Fabo, I said.
And your books came.
What books? I said.
Never more casual.
The Princess Bride, in various languages, one of them, fortunately, English.
Well, that's nice, I said, still loose. I practically forgot I asked to have them sent.
How did they get here?
I called my editor's secretary and had her scrounge up a couple copies. Maybe they had them at Harcourt's, who knows? They did have copies there. Can you buy that? I'll get to why in the next pages, probably. Give me the kid.
Hi,
he said a second later. Listen, Jason, I told him. We thought about giving you a bike for your birthday, but we decided against it.
Boy, are you wrong. I got one already.
Jason had inherited his mother's total lack of humor. I don't know. Maybe he's funny and I'm not. We just don't laugh much together, is all I can say for sure. My son Jason is this incredible looking kid. Paint him yellow, he'd mop up for a school sumo team, a blimp, all the time stuffing his face. I watch my weight, and old Helen is only visible, full front plus on top of which, she is this leading child shrink in Manhattan, and our kid can roll faster than he can walk.
He's expressing himself through food, Helen always says. His anxieties. When he feels ready to cope, he'll slim down.
Hey, Jason. Mom tells me this book arrived today. The Princess Thing. I'd sure like it if maybe you'd give it a read while I'm gone. I loved it when I was a kid, and I'm kind of interested in your reaction.
Do I have to love it too?
He was his mother's son, all right. Jason, no. Just the truth. Exactly what you think. I miss you, Big Shot. And I'll talk to you on your birthday.
Boy, are you wrong. Today is my birthday.
We bantered a bit more, long past when there was much to say. Then I did the same with my spouse and hung up, promising a return by the end of 1 week. It took two. Conferences dragged. Producers got inspirations that had to carefully get shot down. Directors needed their egos soothed. Anyway, I was longer than anticipated in sunny California. Finally, though, I was allowed to return to the care and safety of the family, so I quick buzzed to LA Airport before anybody's mind changed. I got there early, which I always do when I come back, because I had to load up my pockets with doodads and such for Jason. Every time I get home from a trip, he runs, waddles, to me hollering, Let me see the pockets! And then he goes through all of my pockets, taking out his graft, and once the loot is totaled, he gives me a nice hug. Isn't it awful what we'll do in this world to feel wanted?
Let me see the pockets!
Jason shouted, moving to me across the foyer. It was a supper time Thursday, and while he went through his ritual, Helen emerged from the library and kissed my cheek, going,
What a dashing looking fellow I have.
Which is also ritual, and laden with gifts, Jason kind of hugged me and belted off, waddled off, to his room.
Angelica's just getting dinner on, Helen said. You couldn't have timed it better.
Angelica?
Helen put her finger to her lips and whispered, It's her third day on, but I think she may be a treasure.
I whispered back, What was wrong with the treasure we had when I left? She'd only been with us a week then.
She proved a disappointment,
Helen said. That was all. Helen is this brilliant lady, junior Pi Beta in college, every academic honor conceivable, really an intellect of startling breadth and accomplishment. Only, she can't keep a maid. First, I guess she feels guilty having anybody, since most of the anybodies available nowadays are black or Spanish, and Helen is ultra super liberal. Second, she's so efficient, she scares them. She can do everything better than they can, and she knows it, and she knows they know it. Third, once she's got them panicked, she tries to explain, being an analyst, why they shouldn't be frightened. And after a good solid half-hour ego search with Helen, they're really frightened. Anyway, we have had an average of 4 treasures a year for the last few years. We've been running in bad luck, but it'll change, I said, just as reassuringly as I knew how. I used to heckle her about the help problem, but I learned that was not necessarily wise. Dinner was ready a little later, and with an arm around my wife and an arm around my son, I advanced towards the dining room. I felt at that moment safe, secure, all of the nice things. Supper was on the table, cream spinach, mashed potatoes, gravy and pot roast, Terrific, except I don't like pot roast, since I'm a rare meat man. But cream spinach, I have a lech for. So all in all, a more than edible spread was set across the tablecloth. We sat, Helen served the meat, the rest we passed. My pot roast slice was not terribly moist, but the gravy could compensate. Helen rang. Angelica appeared, maybe 20 or 18, swarthy, slow-moving.
Angelica,
Helen began, this is Mr. Goldman. I smiled and said, hi, and waved a fork. She nodded back.
Angelica, this is not meant to be construed as criticism, since what happened is all my fault. But in the future, we must both try very hard to remember that Mr. Goldman likes his roast beef rare.
This was roast beef? I said. Helen shot me a look.
Now, Angelica, there is no problem, and I should have told you more than once about Mr. Goldman's preferences. But next time we have boned rib roast, let's all do our best to try and make the middle pink, shall we?
Angelica backed into the kitchen, another treasure down the tubes. Remember now, we all three started this meal happy. Two of us are left in that state, Helen clearly being distraught. Jason was piling the mashed potatoes onto his plate with a practiced and steady motion. I smiled at my kid.
Hey, I tried. Let's go a little easy, huh, fella?
He splattered another fat spoonful onto his plate.
Jason, they're just loaded, I said then.
I'm really hungry, Dad,
he said, not looking at me.
Fill up on the meat then, why don't you? I said. Eat all the meat you want, I won't say a word.
I'm not eating nothing, Jason said, and he shoved his plate away and folded his arms and stared off into space.
If I were a furniture salesperson, Helen said to me, or perhaps a teller in a bank, I could understand. But how can you have spent all these years married to a psychiatrist and talk like this? You're out of the dark ages, Willie.
Ellen, the boy is overweight. All I suggested was he might leave a few potatoes for the rest of the world and stuff on this lovely prime pot roast your treasure has whipped up for my triumphant return.
Willie, I don't want to shock you, but Jason happens to have not only a very fine mind, but also exceptionally keen eyesight. When he looks at himself in the mirror, I assure you, he knows he is not slender. That is because he does not choose at this time to be slender.
He's not that far from dating, Helen. What then?
Jason is 10, darling, and not interested at this stage in girls. At this stage, he is interested in rocketry. What difference does a slight case of overweight make to a rocket lover? When he chooses to be slender, I assure you he has both the intelligence and the willpower to become slender. Until that time, please, in my presence, do not frustrate the child.
Sandy Sterling, in her bikini, was dancing behind my eyes.
I'm not eating and that's it, Jason said then.
Sweet child,
Helen said to the kid, in that tone she reserves on this earth only for such moments.
Be logical. If you do not eat your potatoes, you will be upset, and I will be upset. Your father clearly is already upset. If you do eat the potatoes, I shall be pleased, and you will be pleased, your tummy will be pleased. We can do nothing about your father. So, you have it in your power to upset all or one, about whom, as I have already said, we can do nothing. Therefore, the conclusion should be clear, but I have faith in your ability to reach it yourself. Do what you will, Jason.
He began stuffing the potatoes in.
You're making a poof out of that kid,
I said, only not loud enough for anybody but me and Sandy to hear. Then I took a deep, deep breath, because whenever I come home, there's always trouble, which is because Helen says I bring tension with me. I always need inhuman proof that I've been missed, that I'm still needed, loved, etc. All I know is I hate being away, but coming home is the worst. There's never really much chance to go into, well, what's new since I'm gone, chit-chat, seeing that Helen and I talk every night anyway.
I'll bet you're a whiz on that bike, I said then. Maybe we'll go for a ride this weekend.
Jason looked up from his potatoes.
I really loved the book, Dad. It was great.
I was surprised that he said it, because naturally, I was just starting to work my way into that subject matter. But then, as Helen's always saying, Jason ain't no dummy.
Well, I'm glad,
I said, and was I ever? Jason nodded.
Maybe it's even the best I read in all my life.
I nibbled away at my spinach.
What was your favorite part?
Chapter 1, The Bride, Jason said. That really surprised me. Not that Chapter 1 stinks or anything, but there's not much that goes on compared with the incredible stuff later. Buttercup grows up mostly is all.
How about the climb up the cliffs of insanity?
I said then. That's it, Chapter 5.
Oh, great, Jason said. And that description of Prince Humperdinck's Zoo of Death.
That's in the second chapter.
Even greater. What knocked me out about it, I said, was that it's this very short little passage on the Zoo of Death, but yet somehow you just know it's going to figure in later. Did you get that same feeling?
Uh-huh. Jason nodded.
Great.
By then, I knew he hadn't read it.
He tried to read it, Helen cut in. He did read the first chapter. Chapter 2 was impossible for him. So when he'd made a sufficient and reasonable attempt, I told him to stop. Different people have different tastes. I told him you'd understand, Willie.
Of course I understood. I felt just so deserted, though.
I didn't like it, Dad. I wanted to.
I smiled at him. How could he not like it? Passion, duels, miracles, giants, true love.
You're not eating the spinach either,
Helen said. I got up.
Time change. I'm not hungry.
She didn't say anything until she heard me open the front door.
Where are you going?
She called out then. If I'd known, I would have answered. I wandered through December in New York. No top coat. I wasn't aware of being cold, though. All I knew was, I was 40 years old, and I didn't mean to be here when I was 40. Locked with this genius shrink wife and this balloon son. It must have been 9 o'clock, when I was sitting in the middle of Central Park alone, no one near me, no other bench occupied. That was when I heard the rustling in the bushes. It stopped. Then again, very soft, nearer.
Can I get you anything?
I said no. Then I went to the library, closed myself in, hunted out the Princess Bride. It was in pretty good shape. I realized as I checked the binding, which is when I saw it was published by my new publishing house, Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. This was before that. They weren't even Harcourt Brace and World yet, just plain old Harcourt, Brace, period. I flicked to the title page, which was funny since I'd never done that before. It was always my father who'd done the handling. I had to laugh when I saw the real title, because right there it said, The Princess Bride, S. Morgan Stern's classic tale of true love and high adventure. You had to admire a guy who called his own new book a classic before it was published and anybody else had a chance to read it. Maybe he figured, if he didn't do it, nobody would. Or maybe he was just trying to give the reviewers a helping hand. I don't know. I skimmed the first chapter, and it was pretty much exactly as I remembered. Then I turned to the second chapter, the one about Prince Humperdinck, and the little kind of tantalizing description of the Zoo of Death. And that's when I began to realize the problem. Not that the description wasn't there, it was, and again, pretty much as I remembered it. But before you got to it, there were maybe 60 pages of text dealing with Prince Humperdinck's ancestry, and how his family got control of Florin, and this wedding, and that child begetting, this one over there, who then married somebody else, and then I skipped to the third chapter, the courtship. And that was all about the history of Guldur, and how that country reached its place in the world. The more I flipped on, the more I knew, Morgenstern wasn't writing any children's book. He was writing a kind of satiric history of his country, and the decline of the monarchy in Western civilization. But my father only read me the action stuff. The good parts.
He never bothered with the serious side at all. About 2 in the morning, I called Hiram in Martha's Vineyard. Hiram Hayden's been my editor for a dozen years ever since Soldier in the Rain, and we've been through a lot together, but never any phone calls at 2 in the morning. To this day, I know he doesn't understand why I couldn't wait till maybe breakfast.
You sure you're all right, Bill?
He kept saying. Hey, Hiram, I began after 6 rings. Listen, you guys published a book just after World War I. Do you think it might be a good idea for me to abridge it, and we'll republish it now?
Are you sure you're all right, Bill?
Absolutely fine, and see, I just used the good parts. I'd kind of bridge where there were skips in the narrative and leave the good parts alone. What do you think?
Bill, it's 2 in the morning up here. Are you still in California?
I acted like I was all shocked and surprised so he wouldn't think I was a nut. I'm sorry, Hiram. My God, what an idiot. It's only 11 o'clock in Beverly Hills. Do you think you could ask Mr. Jovanovich, though?
You mean now?
Tomorrow or the next day. No big deal.
I'll ask him anything. Only I'm not quite sure I'm getting an accurate reading on what exactly you want. You're sure you're all right, Bill?
I'll be in New York tomorrow. Call you then about the specifics, okay?
Could you make it a little earlier in the business day, Bill?
I laughed and we hung up. And I called Zig in California. Everett Ziegler had been my movie agent for maybe 8 years. He did the Butch Cassidy deal for me, and I woke him up too. Hey, Zig, could you get me a postponement on the Stepford Wives? There's this other thing that's come up.
Your contract is to start now. How long a postponement?
I can't say for sure. I've never done an abridgment before. Just tell me what you think they'd do.
I think if it's a long postponement, they'd threaten to sue, and you'd end up losing the job.
It came out pretty much as he said. They threatened to sue and I almost lost the job and some money and didn't make any friends in the industry, as those of us in showbiz call movies. But the abridgment got done. And you hold it in your hands. The good parts version. Why did I go through all that? Helen pressured me greatly to think about an answer. She felt it was important. Not that she know necessarily, but that I know.
Because you acted crackers, Willie boy, she said. You had me truly scared.
So why? I never was worth beans at self-scrutiny. Everything I write is impulse. This feels right, that sounds wrong, like that. I can't analyze, not my own actions anyway. I know I don't expect this to change anybody else's life the way it altered mine. But take the title words. True love and high adventure. I believed in that once. I thought my life was going to follow that path. Prayed that it would. Obviously it didn't, but I don't think there's high adventure left anymore. Nobody takes out a sword nowadays and cries, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." And true love, you can forget about that too. I don't know if I love anything truly anymore, beyond the porterhouse at Pete Luger's and the cheese enchilada at El Prado's. Sorry about that, Ellen. Anyway, here's the good parts version. S. Morgan Stern wrote it, and my father read it to me, and now I give it to you. What you do with it will be of more than passing interest to us all. New York City, December 1972, William Goldman. So why this, why now, and why here? Because The Princess Bride is an amazing movie. Everyone I know of who is pretty much worth talking to has seen it. And this introduction casts an entirely new light into the scenes with Fred Savage when you realize that, yeah, the grandfather reading to the boy, well, it's not quite what happened in history. But something like that happened. And that is a theme throughout the entire movie. It is all based on history. And I think that is probably the most beautiful.
beautiful part about it. This has been Tactically Kinky, and I hope you have some sweet dreams.